by the time I wrote Kitchen Confidential, I was already 44. So, you know, there were a lot of things I hadn't denied myself a lot of things.
I was on stage with my boy Sammy Hagar. We were rocking out. Just to come and find out, I think they had my mic turned down. And when we finished, he looked at everybody and says, well, it sure is good this guy can cook.
I was on like a 20-year ride with agoraphobia, and there were times where I couldn't go to the back of the store.
Ted Sarandos of Netflix has gone on record by saying this is his favorite pitch in one line. I'm exactly like Anthony Bourdain if he was afraid of everything.
It's probably the simplest recipe in the world. It's about 6 steps. Get a rabbit, break its bones, cut it in pieces, and seal it in a pie and bake it.
Now it's almost like everyone can go on TV because there are so many different channels. And you know, the funny thing is, a lot of them don't really know how to cook.
Hi, and welcome back to another Theme Machine. I'm John Carney. And in an effort to cover as much ground as possible, we've cooked up a new topic this time. It's food. Sure, we all eat, but only some of you make it. Some of you buy it. Some of you teach others how to make it. And some of you even critique it. We'll share visits with all of those folks this time around. So pull up a seat at the table as the Theme Machine is underway. Let's start with people tasked with showing us what to do in the kitchen. Jacques Pepin, I took Spanish, so I don't know, is regarded to be one of the first TV chefs. He even did a show a while back with Julia Child. It always seemed amazing to me, though, that someone who could not only make incredible meals, but look into the camera and be our friend at the same time. How do they do that?
Other professional chefs. See, what happened is that you do repeat and repeat and repeat so much those techniques. I mean, when I was a kid, that now I can't afford to forget it because my hands are moving by itself. I can look at the camera or I can think in terms of a combination of ingredients, flavor, and I can talk and my hands are just moving. So, you know, this is, you're a good technician. I mean, if you're a good practice, then it does help a great deal, you know.
You go back a couple of decades and the landscape of people that were coming into our living rooms to teach us how to cook, you could count on one hand. It was you and Julia Childs and the Frugal Gourmet. Now you'd be hard-pressed to find a channel that didn't offer a cooking show. Is it a good thing or is it too much?
It is a good thing, but I mean, I was with a food historian a while ago, and she said that there is 407 cookery shows on television. But it, you know, I think that on PBS, people like Lydia Bastianich or Rick Bayless or Ming Tsai or me, we're still teaching, you know, to a certain extent, and many other shows are not really teaching. I'm not saying that it's worse or better, it's just different than it used to be.
I get food and wine delivered every month. At about every third page is an ad for a food festival, whether it's in Aspen or the Caribbean or on Mars or what. And here you are and Marcus Samuelson and a couple dozen chefs. I would think you could spend every day of your life in a different city at a food festival.
You're absolutely right there.
So I figured you'd be a good one to ask for the average person who wants to save up for an annual vacation and they could maybe go to one of these. How do you pick?
I think the best one is still, in my opinion, Aspen, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe because of the setting is extraordinary and also the fact that no one has a car. So if you go to the one in New York at the Javits Center, you know, you come out and people kind of disseminate throughout the city. But in Aspen, everyone will stay there. So you meet people all the time in the center of town. It's a great venue and it's a fantastic festival.
You talk about staring down 80 years of age. So what is the difference between the culinary taste of Jacques Pepin at 50 and what you reach for to cook at almost 80?
It's different. The challenges are very insidious, you know. It goes so it's not like one morning you get up and all of a sudden it's changed. But if I look at 10, 15 years recipe, then I still try to maybe now go more to the essence, the central taste of the dish, and I try to simplify. You know, when you're a young chef, you tend to add to the plate. And as you get older, as I am, and with metabolism changes and so forth, you kind of take away from the plate to be left with just something essential that you can recognize. So.
That's Master Chef Jacques Pepin, who, believe it or not, actually briefly worked for the Howard Johnson Corporation. We're filling up the cart with food interviews on the Theme Machine this time. And as we continue to highlight some of the educators, we can't leave out Alton Brown, or Alton. His show, Good Eats, debuted on the Food Network back in 1999. We've since seen him on Iron Chef America, other programs, and a live stage show as well. Alton has several cookbooks out, too. And it seems interesting, too, that some people who spent a life in the food business didn't actually start in that industry.
Let's go back to your life prior to culinary pursuits professionally.
I spent most of my early career as a director directing television commercials before Witness Relocation forced me into the culinary business.
And that's a good place for you.
Absolutely.
Were you doing food commercials? Were you doing things?
No, I never did. I was never a food shooter. I hated the artifice of it. I still do. I still really, really don't like food advertising business because, you know, it's like the reason that I don't put pictures of food in my book. It's like advertising and intimidation at the same time. You know, it's not like that food was real. It's not like some stylist didn't spend 6 hours. You know, I've actually watched sesame seeds being glued on Big Mac buns. The pictures and all of that just make us feel inadequate. I can't make food look like that, you know?
And food stylists make ridiculous money.
It's a very lucrative craft if you're good at it, yeah.
But who wants to varnish salmon all day? And that's not even a metaphor for something dirty.
No. Well, in the porn industry, it means something different. But in the food industry, it really is just varnishing salmon.
They really do varnish salmon.
They do. They do indeed, with various different things. And, you know, most of the ice cream is actually a combination of Crisco and potato flakes.
I noticed you've dropped everything and you went to a culinary institute, but who can do that, really?
Not too many folks. I just had it stuck on my craw for a long time that I could make a better food show. And I was really pretty sick of my craft or where I was applying my craft. And my wife, who was a producer and produced for me a lot, was equally lacking in enthusiasm for her current state of things. So her position to me was, look, you want to make a food show, you're going to have to go to culinary school because you don't know enough, even though I'd worked in restaurants through college and whatnot. She said, I tell you what, you apply to the top 3 schools in the country. If you get in, we'll sell the house. We'll go together. She says, we're not going to split up. We'll go together, and wherever we end up, I will work and put you through culinary school. But the deal is that when that's over with, we got to go back to figuring out how to do the show. That's
wow.
The way it worked out. It's good to make good gambles and good decisions while you're gambling. You know, I mean, we rolled the dice, and they worked out for us, and we made good decisions. And I'm really, really fortunate to be having a shot to do something that I believe in.
I never really knew what it was about you that I was so drawn to in this sea of culinary talking heads. And an interview I read just moments ago said you draw upon some of your inspiration for your persona from Monty Python and Julia Childs.
That's kind of what Good Eats was based on, was combining those elements, because I wanted there to be as much entertainment, even for people that didn't care about cooking. And I still hold that that's 100% true.
But I think people are confused. Are you a chef? Are you a magician? Are you a stand-up comic? Or how are they listed on the business card?
I don't have any business cards, and that's one of the reasons. Whenever I have to fill out paperwork and it says, you know, occupation, I always just sit there and stare at the paper. I don't know exactly what I do. Trust me, if people look towards me and say the word chef, I look over my shoulder for somebody in a white hat.
It's one thing when you're in the studio and you have that controlled environment and maybe a belch in the middle of a recipe and it's like, all right, let's take it from the top. Live shows, audiences, you're pulling people up that are either A, seeing this as their opportunity to get into show business, or you get somebody who's absolutely terrified and you need to draw them out.
Or last night, where I had my first person who was legitimately drunk, which I didn't know when I called him up that I was going to be dealing with someone who couldn't walk the straight line. That was a little bit of a challenge. I never encountered that one before. But you never do know. But that's what's so fun about it, is that when you're working with a live audience, anything can happen, and often does. And that's kind of the anti-venom for doing television work, where everything is very, very controlled and in a lot of cases completely pre-planned.
Close to a dozen books out, as well as the TV work and the live stage show. Do you ever worry that you're going to run out of stuff to say and do and cook?
No. What I'm worried about is that I won't shut up before I should shut up.
Now, you got over a couple of decades doing TV work and food. So early on, there weren't all that many. And now you've got more talking heads in the food world than you could possibly count. So if you're just sitting around a channel surfing, when one of these culinary heads pop up, which one will you stop and watch?
I do not watch any food programming at all. And the reason for that is that I'm obsessed with originality. And I'm afraid that if I watch other things, it's going to mess with whatever little bit of magic I might still have in my pocket. So I do not watch anything.
So if your epitaph had a recipe, what would it be?
According to my fans, it would be my Good Eats roast turkey, which seems to be the one thing that people still stop me on the streets for. I think it's got like 25,000 five-star reviews. So I think I told my wife yesterday, my gravestone will actually just be a granite turkey sitting on the ground.
Someone else who's been showing us around the kitchen making Southern staples is Paula Deen. And despite having a popular show, several cookbooks and restaurants, her career came to a pretty abrupt end in 2013 when a lawsuit surfaced accusing her of using racial slurs to some of her employees. And for that reason alone, I wasn't going to use her for this program. But I actually have a whole other episode planned down the road called The Mighty Have Fallen. But I wanted to use this clip because it's hard to believe what she was up against in the beginning and then to actually become a TV chef.
Just to show how busy you are in the course of our conversation, you're readying yourself for a television interview and putting on makeup, which is why the speakerphone is going. And it's a long way to go for somebody who is agoraphobic.
Isn't that just something?
I thought it was interesting that you learned to cook with the items that were close to the door at the grocery store because you didn't want to go in that far.
There were times where I couldn't go to the back of the store.
How did that happen to you? You were outgoing.
I know what caused it, John. It was the premature death of my mother and daddy. Just frightened me so. It stopped my mental growth.
How does somebody who is afraid to go outside develop into an individual who can do a worldwide book tour and a television show? Is there a moment in time you can point to and say,
oh, absolutely,
this is when it changed?
I remember the day.
What happened?
Oh, I was on like a 20-year ride, John, with agoraphobia, and to me, I don't even know if there's such a thing, but to me, I was a functioning agoraphobic. You know, I could actually, you know, pull some things off, especially if I was with my husband, because I put all my security in him.
Was the kitchen all along the way a source of comfort for you?
Oh, it was. I think that room is so therapeutic, you know. I think it's such a great place to heal in, you know, for the whole family. At the end of the day, I think it just offers so much comfort.
You know, and now it's become a giant empire for you.
Yeah.
But doing food for money, as opposed to just the comfort, going back to bag lunches that the kids were shilling in office buildings, at what point did that come about? Did you really think, you know, I might be able to make some money making food and having this knowledge?
Well, you know, when I started the little business, I was desperate.
And the way that it began with your sons, who are now also on television, doing stuff on the Food Network, which I imagine makes you slightly proud.
Oh, just a little bit puffy chest.
Well, to make the jump from that, which became very successful, to opening up the Lady, the restaurant, and later the Lady and Sons. with a 90% failure rate out there of restaurants.
Yes.
Were you horrified, or did it even occur to you that it might not work?
Oh, no. It occurred to me every day that it might not work.
Let's talk a little bit about family, because you have always put family in the forefront now that we've gotten to know you with your wedding a couple years ago on television, pictures of the kids now having their show, this book talking about triumphs and also your tragedies in a very public way.
I have voluntarily shared a lot about my life, a lot about the personal side of my life. And people do feel like they know me. They, not a day goes by that somebody doesn't run up and hug me and say, oh, my goodness, I feel like you're my sister or my mother or my grandmother or my next-door neighbor. You're my best friend.
You come to understand it better because you're the one who's in front of the camera. The kids and stuff that don't have that part of the exposure, when they get hit with, oh, so I heard you went to camp last summer in Michigan, they get a little freaked out. Have you had conversations like that with other members of the family?
We have, but they know that Mama's out there talking a lot. And sister's out there talking a lot, and auntie's out there talking a lot, and stepmother's out there talking a lot. You know, I wear a lot of different hats.
Do you cook at home at all, or are you even home at all?
I'm not home much, John.
This is The Theme Machine. I'm John Carney, and I can't think of anybody who's made cooking more hip than the late Anthony Bourdain. We know him mostly from his travel shows, but he came from the kitchen, Mihalis in New York, to be specific. But when he chronicled that experience in his first book, Kitchen Confidential, he had no idea how much his life would change.
My life has changed, you know, stratospherically. I mean, when I wrote Kitchen Confidential, I was standing in a kitchen 14 hours a day. You know, now I travel around the world eating and drinking for a living. So, you know, I'm kind of coming to terms with both those things.
A lot of your appeal for me and for a lot of people is that, you know, you seem like an everyday guy that would be approachable and we could sit down and have one or 12 vodkas with you. Is it harder for you to maintain that in your own head just because your life is anything but normal?
I mean, I know who I am. I mean, even when I, by the time I wrote Kitchen Confidential, I was already 44. So, you know, there were a lot of things I hadn't denied myself a lot of things. So I think I had a pretty reasonable attitude even then about the way things were. But, I mean, it has gotten weird. I mean, going into a bar and sitting down by myself and having a beer in the late afternoon is, you know, tougher. You know, it's an interactive experience now. You know, I can't go into a bar, sit down, and feel sorry for myself and have a nice, you know, have a put on some Tom Waits and sip some whiskey. You know, that's changed a little bit. But it's a small price to pay for the fact that you know, life is good. I mean, I have the best job in the world. So if somebody stops me in an airport and asks me to sign an autograph, this is, you know, hardly a burden.
Do you see the inside of a kitchen much without a camera crew?
No. I mean, if I'm going back to the kitchen at Leal, chances are it's to make a show. I'm past it. You know, I was 44 10 years ago for Kitchen Confidential. So, you know, I'm way beyond the spoilage date for line cooks, you know.
Do you miss it at all?
I miss the camaraderie, of course. I miss sitting at the bar after a busy night, sitting around with the crew, you know, having a cold beer, feeling like on top of the world for having done a hard thing well.
There's like 12 chefs that don't have TV shows.
That seems like that sometimes, right?
It's crazy. And, you know, a lot of them I've never heard of. And the next thing you know, they've got their line of cookware out at Macy's. And what the hell?
I don't know how it happened. I don't know why it happened, but I'm glad it happened. I mean, who better than chefs to put down a nice score? You know, I mean, chefs do something useful. They nurture, they feed you. They know they have a real skill that you know would be useful on a desert island. You know, I think it's long overdue, and I'm happy about it. I mean, let's face it, the celebrity chef thing is a nice scam.
No reservations on the Travel Channel. How much of it is you saying, you know what? Let's go to Phnom Penh. I hear the chicken's fantastic.
That's 100%. That's the way we make the show.
That's kind of nice.
Yeah, I mean, we go wherever I want to go. Do you get, don't go anywhere that I don't want to go.
Do you get to keep the frequent flyer miles?
Yes, I do.
And when we see you doing a show, who's there?
Two camera people, a producer who also carries a camera, and an assistant. So it's a four-person crew plus me.
Have you found yourself in a position where, you know, I need to save face and get this down, but I'd be really surprised if I didn't hurl on my host?
Yeah, it's come up a few times.
Literally.
Alcohol really helps in those situations.
I've noticed that.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, there have been a few times where I knew I was taking one for the team, and I knew I was going to pay a price for it later.
What was the worst?
That would be the warthog rectum in Namibia. You know, medium rare, semi-cleaned. It was about as awful a thing as you could imagine.
How much of your life is studying food and its history? Is that of interest to you?
A lot. I mean, it's a lot about shows a lot about that. I mean, I'm not just interested in what's cooking. I'm interested in who's cooking.
This is The Theme Machine. I'm John Carney, and it's food this time as we change it up and come out of the kitchen and feature some of the folks that talk food but don't necessarily make it. Phil Rosenthal had his hand in TV. He was largely responsible for Everybody Loves Raymond and bringing that to life. And when it came to creating Somebody Feed Phil, which is in its eighth season on Netflix, that wasn't an easy task.
It took me 10 years. I just want you to know. And that was after I had been somewhat successful on television. So it's not easy. Now, which, if you ask me, was it worth it? Yeah, it was. Look at me now. But it was. Here's the pitch. And Ted Sarandos of Netflix has gone on record by saying this is his favorite pitch in one line that he's heard. I'm exactly like Anthony Bourdain if he was afraid of everything.
I'd hire you. I don't even have a network.
It was 10 years of knocking on doors.
Sure.
And going, you know, the first place that the agents had me go was the Travel Channel, naturally. So I went to the Travel Channel first. This was, I don't know, 7, 8 years ago. And they said, I met with the president. He goes, we've done some research and we found that our audience really isn't into travel. Yes. I said, oh my, what are you going to do? He goes, well, all our shows are travel adjacent. I said, what the hell does that mean? He said, well, we have a show called Pimp My RV. He says, you understand it? I think so. You pimp an RV, but you don't go anywhere? That's right. And the only food we've done the research, the only food people are interested in is barbecue. I said, okay. And I said to my agents, can we go to a PBS now? Because this seems, this is silly. PBS, I think we would do well there. They said, no, we're going to go to the Food Network. So we go to Food Network. Guess what the Food Network says?
We don't do food.
We're kind of getting away from the food thing. I said, what? What do you mean? Yeah, we're doing food adjacent. They're owned by the same company that owns the Travel Channel. And on my way out of that door, the guy tells me, oh, by the way, the only food that people are interested in, I said, I know, barbecue. And I said, can we go to PBS now? Netflix didn't exist yet. After striking out everywhere, I went to PBS and they gave me I'll Have What Phil's Having, 6 episodes. And I called my brother, who was a producer at the time on other shows. And I said, PBS is going to give me this show where I go around the world and try to convince you to travel by showing you the best places in the world to eat. And he said, really? They're going to give you this show. What are they going to call the show? The Lucky Bastard? And I said, quit your job. Come produce this with me, and we'll call our production company Lucky Bastard. And that's what it is. And we did it for 6 episodes. And then PBS did not pick up that show. That's when I pitched to Netflix, and that's where I am now.
Somebody Feed Phil. It's on Netflix. Do you pick the spots where you want to go?
I do. I get to, you know, I'm very open to suggestion, but I get to have the ultimate say. And usually I will suggest a place, and I do what everyone else can do. I look on my phone, and I start doing the research.
The level of access has always struck me as absolutely amazing. I was watching your Italy episode, and the mayor of the town invites you to the family's place, and you're eating with his mother, and, you know, you don't find that on Yelp.
That's exactly right. You have to go, and you have to be open to stuff.
I think it was a Japan episode I saw where you were at a table and they had incorporated sensor round from the movie Earthquake, and things were moving and smoke was shooting out, and it was dinner by Cirque du Soleil. And I'm like, well, it looks interesting, but I'm thinking, what kind of bill comes at the end of the night of one of these meals?
Yeah, what's nice is that because we're filming and I'm in it, I never see the bill.
Phil Rosenthal on The Theme Machine. Another person on TV that chats about food but doesn't necessarily make it is Guy Fieri. We see him everywhere, which is a far cry from his start selling pretzels as a kid from the back of his bike. After winning the Next Food Network Star, which was back in 2006, there's been no looking back.
I'm looking at all the shows that you're involved in, and I figured, if we can get you dancing and or singing and get you those spots on American Idol and Dancing with the Stars, you'll officially be on every television show on TV.
Well, I think everybody's going to be safe to know that I do not sing very well. I sing so poorly, I don't even sing in the shower. I was on stage with my boy Sammy Hagar. We were rocking out, singing one of my favorite songs. I Can't Drive 55. I was having the best time of my life. Just to come and find out, I think they had my mic turned down. And when we finished in front of 10,000 hometown fans, he looked at everybody and says, well, it sure is good this guy can cook.
We had a chance to visit the day after you had won the competition to get your own show. I guess that was 2005, maybe?
Wasn't that 1895? Well, it has been mind-blowing, I will tell you that much. And I just thought it'd be cool to go on the show and, you know, meet Emeril and Bobby Flay and all that kind of stuff. So winning was not even really in the cards or not in my game plan. But, yeah, things have been nuts.
Let's talk about the food book. And it's a little surprising that it took a life in food, going back to selling pretzels at age six, for you to finally put out a cookbook at this point. Why now, and when did you start setting this stuff in folders going, you know, someday I'm going to put this in a cookbook?
Well, I think as any chef has or wants to do, is they want to write the book. Like, what is going to be the defining book? You know, you'll do a lot of books, but one of my managers, Reed, was saying, you know, you never get a chance to do this book again because you've given all the stories. You know, you've given all the background. I said, oh, you have no clue what I've got locked away in this in this pumpkin of mine. And the real kicker to it, and this is what was so great dealing with my team at HarperCollins who published the book, is I said, I want to do tattoo artwork. You know, really cool illustrations inside the book. And Cassie Jones, my editor, she said, I don't exactly understand it, but let's take a look.
Let me ask you about the body art for a minute. I was reading somewhere, and it was on the internet, and these always bite me in the butt when I run it by a guest. Is there a tattoo on you that commemorates the great daredevil, Evel Knievel?
Oh, there is a. Under my right arm is the big number one, the Evel Knievel. And it's done in Evel Knievel style with the stars and stripes, but it's also got the filigree of a slot machine number from old Las Vegas.
Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives still on TV. So if your digestive system was able to speak to you verbally, what would it tell you was the occasion where you really hurt me the most?
I think it's when I get home and I hit the butcher shop and the seafood market. I go see my fishmonger, and I pop off, you know, a good seven or eight items and anything that has to do with something spicy and meaty and, you know, some carbs and so forth. So I've hurt myself, you know, because when I'm doing television, we're shooting two and three locations in a day. I can't eat as much as I really want to because it'll slow me down. So
that's my big fear, that when I die, I'm going to come back as Andrew Zimmer's lower intestines.
I was just talking to Andrew today, and I told him, I said, brother, he goes, we should go do a show together. I said, it's just going to be me watching, man, because unless you take me over to, Joey's Philly cheesesteaks, in some foreign country, I don't think I can eat beating frog heart.
All right, it's the last meal for you. You get one thing on a plate, and then it's all over for Guy Fieri. What's that going to be?
Very simple. Pasta with tomato sauce, and maybe a veal chop, and perhaps an egg roll, and then, something along the lines of some oysters Rockefeller, and then, just maybe a little shrimp scampi.
That might be the largest plate ever created.
That's what my wife says when I make food. She's like, nobody makes spaghetti and egg rolls in the same meal.
Minute to Win It, you're the host of that show, kind of takes you out of the culinary circles, but I watch these things that they make people do, and what's most amazing to me is not so much them doing it, but there were people in a room that sat and came up with it.
You think that tripped you out. They bring these games to me and said, hey, here's a new game that we got. And I look at it, and I'm like, these are people I work with. They worry me. What were you doing when you came up with this one? What were you drinking? How long had you been up? What was sleep deprivation doing to you?
So I go to the website, and I'm looking around at the online store, and that alone took me an hour. Here's the watches he wears. Here's the jewelry he wears. Here's the shirts that he has. Here's the sunglasses he likes. There's 9 different watches on there. So is it a point now where you're getting all this stuff in the mail? Wear my watch. Wear these pants. Well, I ask about that because I'm just curious of some of the things that have been put before you where you were like, what? We think the Guy Fieri dental floss dispenser is going to be the next big thing.
Yeah. No, when they came to me with the Guy Fieri, sports action unitard, I wasn't so interested in that. That wasn't, regardless of the fact that it was, decorated and adorned with, cheeseburgers and French fries. So no, we didn't go with that one.
It's the Theme Machine. I'm John Carney. And one of my favorites this time is food. Even though I've worked in some kitchens over the years myself, I can't imagine the pressure one would feel if every dish you made was set in front of royalty. But that's exactly the situation for Chef Darren McGrady, who in 1982 was hired to cook for British royalty.
I mean, I spent 11 years with the Queen as her personal chef at Buckingham Palace. Then when Prince Charles and Princess Diana separated, Princess Diana asked me if I'd go and become her chef at Kensington Palace. So I moved across to Kensington to take care of the princess, Prince William and Prince Harry, cooking for them on a day-to-day basis.
All right, so let's go back to when Chuck and Di split up and Princess Di wants you to come with her. Was there any word from the Queen or Charlie saying, what do you think you're doing, Darren? Where are you going with those pots and pans?
Well, she did have her own pots and pans, so we were lucky there. But, the Queen has 20 chefs at Buckingham Palace, and she needs those 20 chefs.
Oh, come on!
No, she does. She needs them because, listen, they can do, dinner for two for the Queen and Prince Philip one night. They've got 300 staff every day to cook for. But they could also have a garden party at Buckingham Palace for 6,000 people, or a state banquet for President Reagan, Ford, Bush, etc., for 250 people. So, and then, of course, there's all the other houses. There's a Balmoral Castle, Windsor Castle, Sandringham House, and, of course, when I was there, the Royal Yacht Britannia, too. So those chefs just travel around the world with the Queen. So the Queen didn't miss one chef.
Did you ever, or one meal, probably. So did you get, say there were going to be 40 people having dinner with the Queen? Would you actually get a list of stuff, or would they say to you, look, you could only spend 20 quid? Was there a budget, or could you go
absolutely
crazy?
Absolutely not, no budget. No. Never had a budget. All the time working for the princess, all the time working for the Queen, didn't have to work on a budget. But having said that, they were pretty frugal. For example, the Queen, yes, of course, she'd have a rack of lamb sent around from Harrods for dinner that evening. But, if she was having shrimp or salmon, the first course, you try sending up half a lemon as a little garnish. she sent me back down to the kitchen saying, you know, you can use this for something else. slice it into my gin and tonic or something.
I don't imagine the Queen or Charles actually were the ones to sit down with you and say, right then, okay, you're in. But at some point, you had the meeting, and I'm sure that's fairly clear in your mind, your first experience with both of them up close.
You know, the interview process was pretty tough, but I never actually met the Queen until about a month later when I moved to Balmoral Castle, and then I just bumped into her one day.
Did you get to have a visit at any point working there?
Well, the Queen would come into the kitchen quite often, but it was really, you know, the foodies, Prince Charles, Prince Philip, Prince Andrew, Prince Edward, they love the food, love to cook, and certainly eat it. So they'd come into the kitchen a lot more. And of course, you know, when Princess Diana was there, then she would come into the kitchen too and bring William and Harry as they were growing up. I knew sort of both boys as tiny, tiny babies.
So you mentioned the royal kitchen. What would surprise us about that? I mean, were there like a cheap wooden spoon in there that you used to think, well, this is odd that this would be in here?
You think in the royal kitchens, okay, they're going to have all the best induction ovens and all the latest cookware and everything, but that's not true. The wooden spoons are all warped and twisted, like the chefs. And the all of the cookware, the pots and pans, all date back to the 1800s. They have Queen Victoria's logo on them. It's antique copper pans, tin-lined. And all the cookware is just, you know, over 100 years old. When we traveled to Balmoral Castle for 8 weeks, where the Queen would probably have 20, 25 guests, we would pack the tiniest little ice cream maker you ever did see. It made one pint of ice cream. And we would travel this all the way to Scotland, you know, 500-600 miles. And then from there, it would go to Sandringham House in Norfolk. We'd travel this one $200 ice cream machine around the country. Do you think this is the Queen of England? She could buy thousands. She could buy every chef one each.
Chef Darren McGrady on the Theme Machine. And if you're so inclined to eat like a royal, many of his recipes are in his cookbook, Eating Royally. I'm John Carney. And since we've started to serve up some of the atypical, we really only have to go back in time to ask ourselves, what were we thinking? Food historian and writer Matt Siegel tracks some of our past culinary habits.
The things that people ate were absolutely grotesque. The mutton and the aspic and everything had lard. And it's amazing how we have evolved in some ways and really devolved in others.
If you look at food historically, we've really put emphasis both on presentation, right, to sort of display foods. And then there's sort of a buzz factor or a stunt factor, what you might call stunt foods, where it's doing something to food to excite people and blow people's minds and get likes on Instagram. But that doesn't necessarily mean it tastes good or is positive. So, you know, if you look back in medieval times, they were sewing the heads of a chicken onto the body of a pig and baking it to create sort of these edible monstrosities of taxidermy just to impress their guests. And if you look at today, you know, I mean, major food brands are constantly releasing these mashups and these stunt foods and things that are super spicy or, you know, things that have donuts for buns on hamburgers or chicken sandwiches. And, you know, their goal is just to get customers in the door.
Something else I'd never thought about before, that we are the only living thing on the face of this round ball that eat spicy food voluntarily.
It's a head scratcher in terms of food. Why would we seek out something that causes us discomfort when everything else we eat is all about pleasure and comfort? And there's a lot of irony there when you realize that the reason peppers are hot, it's a chemical defense mechanism that evolved to keep us from eating them. From the pepper's perspective, we are a seed-destroying predator. And if we eat one of them, we're going to chew the seeds and destroy them and interfere with the spread of the species. So to keep us away, they developed this chemical defense mechanism to cause us pain. it just so happened that humans are stubborn and not so willing to take no for an answer. And we kept coming back to them and actually started making them even hotter. You know, if you think about food, for much of history, it wasn't what it is today. It was a really bloody affair, right? You were either slaughtering animals or scavenging from dead animals or pulling things from the dirt and eating them. One of the recipes is for a hare pie, and it's probably the simplest recipe in the world. It's about six steps. It goes something like this. Get a rabbit, break its bones, cut it in pieces, and seal it in a pie and bake it.
That's Matt Siegel talking about his book, The Secret History of Food. It's a great read, by the way. This is The Theme Machine, and I'm John Carney. As you can imagine, it takes some pretty mad skills to be able to crank out great meals. I mean, I would think that it would be even harder to describe those meals to people because you could only say swell, delicious, and tasty so many times in a story before it starts to read like a fifth grader's book report. Now, there aren't a whole lot of food writers, but even a shorter list of really good food critics. Ruth Reichel is both.
Garlic and Sapphire is chronicling your life as a food critic professionally on both coasts for the New York Times and also out in Los Angeles. And I love the stories about the personas that you had to take on, not just like wear a hat and glasses. That wouldn't do it. Some of these restaurants had pictures of you in the kitchen, and the servers had to commit your looks to memory. So you actually invented some other people, and I think even your aunt personally.
I even became my mother, which was the spookiest of all of them, because, you know, I looked in the mirror, and I was my mother, and then I channeled her, and it was scary. I mean, her voice was coming out of me. You know, she was a wonderful character, and I used all of her insane antics as fodder for my books. And then when I went and looked at her diaries and letters, I realized that she had given me this enormous gift. And what she had really passed on to me was a dream for what life for an American woman could be like. And her message to me was, you know, I have not been able to work. She wanted to be a doctor, was not allowed to do it. But you take this dream and run with it. Don't be me. Go be your best self. And she gave me this enormous gift that I did not realize that she had consciously done until I went and looked at her diaries and letters.
As a food critic on both coasts, did that take away your love of the meal?
I love to eat. I never stopped loving to eat. I never stopped feeling, I mean, in the 20-some years that I was a restaurant critic, I never stopped thinking, how lucky am I to have this job? Is this, somebody's really paying me to go out to restaurants, take my friends to restaurants? And the thrill of finding, you know, discovering talent, finding, you know, a great young chef that nobody knew about yet. I mean, there's something so wonderful about that. It just never goes away.
Is there a most memorable meal, or is that like asking you who's your favorite child?
You know, I mean, it's just, they keep coming. And, you know, I mean, what's happening in American food today is so thrilling. I mean, the chefs today are more interesting, more intellectually acute. They're more open to experience than any generation before them. To me, it just keeps getting better. I mean, the things, you know, the kind of exciting things that are going on, you just wouldn't have found that.
And that you're synonymous with food. I would think everywhere you go, it's chefs climbing over each other. It'd be like being at a party with Jerry Seinfeld and who can make him laugh.
Yeah, well, it's pretty great, right? You have really talented people trying to make their best food for you. How bad can that be?
Do you get much of an opportunity to cook?
I, you know, of course, right now, I don't have a job at the moment anymore, and all I'm doing these days is cooking, and I'm so excited that I have all this time to cook now.
We were devastated and shocked, as I'm sure you were, probably even more so, that Condé Nast announced they were no longer going to publish Gourmet magazine, and with you as the editor, as you mentioned, don't have a job. I'm sure you'll do fine because people love to meet you and feed you and read your books, and things will continue just fine, of which I'm certain, if no other reason, good things happen to good people. but we lose you coming into our house every month.
We had the perfect dream magazine at Gourmet. We were a wonderful family, and, you know, we're all sort of lamenting that era is over, but it was great while it lasted.
As the editor of a major magazine, as a food critic for major city newspapers, to published author, to host of a television show, if there was one that you could continue to pursue, because, say, I don't know, there weren't enough jobs to go around and everybody could only have one, which would be the pursuit that you would continue, the one that brings the most satisfaction for you?
I'm a writer. And, you know, if I could only do one thing, I'd write books for the rest of my life. But I'm really happy I get to do TV, too, and radio.
And it's a different time on the food front, because what was considered grunt work for a very long time, you know, and I used to cook in restaurants, too, and it was just that, oh, you work in a restaurant, how nice. To now, these chefs being equivalent to rock stars with Emeril and Bobby Flay. And it's good in one sense, but doesn't it also flood the market with people that maybe don't deserve all the attention they're getting?
What's going to happen is that as these people all become businessmen, the people we're going to start paying attention to are the farmers, the artisans, the bakers, you know, all the people who really put their hands on our food. And I think we have a whole new breed of rock stars coming along. Rock star farmers. Doesn't that sound good?
Yeah, I like it. Anything to get the Kardashians off television. Would you get back into the restaurant business?
Me? No. Once you've been a restaurant critic, you have to be really a masochist to open a restaurant. Everybody would come gunning for you.
It's Food This Time on the Feed Machine. I'm John Carney, and as we are trying to fit everything on your plate, we serve you another angle on the subject. Fine dining. Danny Meyer may not be a name you're familiar with, but in the industry, the guy is a rock star. Known for legendary fine dining establishments like Union Square Cafe and Gramercy Tavern in New York, I think we're all a bit stunned, though, when he rolled out Shake Shack.
For a man who has made his mark largely with fine dining, it seems like a burger joint is so far off of that radar. Conceptually, can you point to a moment where that came to you?
I absolutely can. I mean, the thing that I'm consumed with more than anything is hospitality and trying to apply the way we think about hospitality to anything that I love. And I don't really care if it's black truffles or barbecue or burgers or pizza. If it's something that it's a dish that I know and I remember loving at some point in my life, I'm always looking for ways to see if we can present it just a little bit differently. And the moment that Shake Shack occurred to me was quite an accident. It really began because we were trying to bring art to Madison Square Park. Madison Square Park was kind of a forlorn, forgotten park in New York City back in the 1990s. And when we were in the process of opening two restaurants on Madison Square Park, one called 11 Madison Park and the other called Tabla, we engaged the community to raise a bunch of money to make the park beautiful and safe. But then we realized that, you know, unless you have a reason that people actually want to use the park, it'll just return to its decay. And so it made sense, and we said, let's bring art there. And so the very first artist that was curated was a guy from Thailand, and he had this idea for a piece of art that was going to be taxi cabs on stilts accompanied by a working hot dog cart, of all things. and they needed somebody to operate it. So we voluntarily said, we'll be glad to do Chicago-style hot dogs. We cooked them at 11 Madison Park. And that little hot dog cart did so well that even after the art was down, the community asked us to bring it back for two more summers. And then in summer four, we said, why not turn this into a permanent kiosk? And that became Shake Shack. And we just basically, to the hot dogs, we added burgers, fries, and frozen custard, which certainly things I'd grown up loving. And the lines just have not stopped since we opened in 2004. For me, it's not, we have 12 full-service restaurants that you might call fine dining restaurants. And I love those as much as I love anything, but I'm happy to experiment with hospitality because I don't think hospitality knows a price point. I think that whether you're buying something for $8 or $80, you expect the person on the other side to be happy to see you and to be smiling. And that's not about a price point. That's about an attitude.
I watched a documentary on you where I believe at the time you were opening three places simultaneously and they were chronicling that experience. So have you ever opened just one place at a time?
My first restaurant, Union Square Cafe, was one at a time. In fact, that was the only restaurant that I owned for the first nearly 10 years of my career. So I kind of went about this slowly. And then Gramercy Tavern was one at a time. That was about 10 years after Union Square Cafe, 1994. So believe me, I don't have a masochistic trait. You need to do more than one.
So how are you in the kitchen? You run all of these world-class restaurants, but if your chef doesn't show up, could you go in and step up? Do you have the chops to do that?
Not only do I not have the chops, but what I do have is too much respect for our guests to do that ever. I think I'm a really good home cook. I don't think you'd be embarrassed to or I don't think I'd be embarrassed to serve you my cooking at home whatsoever. But I have every self-awareness to know that I was, from a professional standpoint, cut out to be in the dining room, and I'm really good at putting stuff in the glass, and I leave it to others to put the great stuff on the plate.
That's famed restaurateur Danny Meyer. This is The Theme Machine, and I'm John Carney. We have featured a lot of chefs who can whip up amazing dishes, to be sure. Not a lot of them, though, can boast actually creating a dish that becomes famous, like turducken or the blackened fish dishes from Louisiana. Those came from the mind of the late chef Paul Prudhomme.
You're credited with the blackened type of cooking. How did that happen?
Was it
a mistake gone right?
Not really. It was a process that over the years, you know, things have happened at high heat temperature cooking, and it actually started, before Open Cape Olives. But I knew, once I tasted this dish, I knew this was a dish that I had to serve in my own restaurant. And no one else accepted it before my restaurant. I mean, I'd work somewhere else and they'd say, no, it's not a good name, it's not. So the blackening started at Cape Paul's, and it was a way of doing something that I'd seen before, I'd learned before, I'd done before, and to make it, to refine it, to make it real, to make it, put it in somebody's mouth, and it just was amazing. What's really important about blackening, it's a great blend of seasoning, a very hot skillet, it's gotta be cast iron. You got to operate it between 500 and 600 degrees. You got to have fresh fish. If you don't have fresh fish, what blackening does is accents the outside flavors and caramelizes them. And so if there's rancid oil from the fish out there, it's going to accent that. It's going to make it worse. And so you get a good piece of fish, a good piece of chicken, nice and fresh, put a little seasoning on it, put a little butter on it. You got an empty black iron skillet. You get it real hot and you cook it real fast.
You got me started on turducken. I actually got some people together and we tried to make it on three different occasions and we ran out of beer. So we didn't actually get it finished. The turkey, duck, chicken, turducken, now you can get pre-made in stores, but that takes hours. How did that come up?
Well, it was a long process. I was working in Wyoming at a resort. And I was the carver on the buffet line. And when you'd carve a turkey, as you carve the breast, the breast bone always had meat left on it, and the light would dry it, and it would stick out. And I just thought, I can't stand here next to something that looks like it's got hair sticking out on it, And so I started looking at ways to do that. And, one of the first things I did is boned out a turkey, and I made a turkey roll, and it was awful, because the skin was underneath and, all that. And so over probably a process of 10 years, I started inserting things into it. And I came up with a duck and a chicken and a turkey. And the name happened when I did it at Cape Paul's after it was open. I used to do a radio show. And there was a radio guy named Frank Davis, and he would be at the station, and I'd be cooking in my kitchen on Saturdays because it was closed on Saturday. And we'd do a radio show together. We'd do 2 hours. And so we did this dish, and like, I mean, the restaurant filled up with people because we talked about it before. And after the show was over, because I call it duck, chicken, turkey or something like that, and he came up and I came up sort of with the name together of Turducken.
There's websites, there's books, there's tributes, there's all, you know, Turducken's taken on a life of its own.
That concludes our meal this week. I hope you enjoyed our dive into the culinary arts. We'll come back to this subject another time as we have lots of other visits to share. Next time, though, we go out of this world and check out UFOs and other explainables, like the career of Kim Kardashian. The Theme Machine wouldn't make it if it weren't for invaluable production assistance from Everett Marshall Creative. And you can find The Theme Machine anywhere you get your podcast. Be sure to subscribe, leave some comments as well. I'm John Carney, and we'll see you next time. Be good to each other.